I'm on the phone with Patrick Bristow, co-creator, director, and host of Puppet Up, playing at the Ricardo Montalban Theater, July 31st to August 9th. More information at puppetup.com. And this is a product of the Henson Workshop. Explain to me.
Yeah, it's a show that was co-created by Brian Henson and myself. He brought me in about 20 some odd years ago to teach improv to the puppeteers that he hired on a regular basis, because he wanted them to kind of increase their ability to ad lib and be looser with scripts, which is something that his dad, Jim Henson, really valued in performers. And he wanted to get back to that. So I taught a 6-week course in improv, and I had to adjust the technique from something that is designed for human beings with eye contact back and forth and those kind of micro communications to be able to have now to puppeteers who are working in the Henson style, which means that they are puppeteering over their head and they're looking at a TV monitor, not at each other. So we had a lot of fun exploring how to get that connection with each other without actual eye contact. And it went very well. And then we decided to do a little demonstration that was going to be invitational to maybe employees. And Brian, he doesn't do things by half measures. So he did an invitational evening on the soundstage at the Henson Studios, formerly Chaplin, and invited like 200 people. And we had bleachers and full tech and everything. And from there, it just got invited to festivals. And we refined it over the years and expanded it. And now it's Puppet Up! Exclamation point.
So this was a natural kind of organic emergence just from people being creative. And now it's turned into this huge production.
It's a juggernaut, damn it.
You're going to be at the Ricardo Montalban Theater for a run, and it's touring the country.
Yeah, we'll start touring different regions end of September, and that'll go through like late spring next year. So we'll go out on the road, we'll come back, recover from it, go out on the road again. So we're really looking forward to that, because we're getting to a lot of cities that we've been to before and have been a lot of fun, and then a lot of new cities.
And your background is as an actor or in improv?
Started out as an actor at LMU.
Oh, I like that.
Yes, theater major, 1980-81. Discovered improv in the mid-80s and really felt that that was kind of a good fit for me, improv and sketch. So I was with the Groundlings for about 5 years in the main company, and I continued to teach and direct there for a long time afterwards. And then I kind of hung my own shingle and wanted to teach improv in a little bit different way than was right for that conservatory model of the Groundlings School. That's how I ended up meeting Brian and got this whole insane puppet improv ball rolling.
A lot of you guys in the Groundlings community will have really taken over the comedy and acting world. So
that was the plan, yeah.
Good job. Well, when we think of puppets, we think of kids.
Yes. And that was a big stumbling block for us marketing this show in the beginning, because other than Avenue Q, people didn't really associate puppets with adult content.
So there's an improvisational element.
Yeah. And our puppeteers, the voices that they're using for the various puppets they pick up, they have 80 puppets at their disposal for any given show. They're using voices that are less puppety and more recognizable, you know, human archetypes, and voices that you would hear over the phone and just go, that's just a regular person.
So interesting. I've seen some of Jim's early work, and some of it's very political, some tackling environmental issues. I mean, very pointed stuff. And even you have someone like Pee Wee Herman, Paul Rubens. His early material was pretty edgy. So puppeteering around the world is not exclusively for children. It's often an adult modality and can tap into archetypes that we're thinking and we're feeling that adults respond to. We understand these things, and now in a very purified format, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has, the puppetry as an art form has so many applications. We in 20th and 21st century America tend to just think, oh, it's for the kids. And a lot of it, you know, has been in terms of what we're exposed to. But internationally and culturally over centuries, it has many, many other applications and uses and tones and styles and it's and visual vocabulary of the puppets. You know, they can be absolutely gorgeous and maybe just suggestive of reality, like Warhorse or something, you know, and manipulated beautifully to look as if it's a sentient, you know, living being. So it's a beautiful art form.
Well, I grew up with Kukla, Fran and Ollie and Lamb Chop and a few other ones. I can't quite remember, but, you know, it was always a child's experience, but here you're making it accessible to a wider audience.
Yes, and it's interesting that you brought up those iconic puppet shows, because when puppetry was originally done on TV, they would set up a little puppet stage like you would at a birthday party or at a carnival, you know, the little window in a flat, and your human host would maybe stand in front of it and deal with the puppets. Jim brilliantly thought, well, the TV screen is a puppet theater. So let's push right up to the frame there and let that be the world, the window into the world that we're bringing you into. And some of his puppet designs early had a squarishness to them with a slight parabolic kind of edge, much like the early TV screens did. They were like, even Bert and Ernie have that kind of weird, I don't know what you'd call it. It's a weird oval, you know, version of a rectangle or version of a square that I'm sure it's something I'm just missed in basic geometry. But I know that his design of those puppets was in light of the design and shape of the contemporary TV screen at that time. So he really was a massive television innovator as much as he was, you know, just a puppeteer, storyteller, director, artist. He's kind of like Ernie Kovacs in a way. It's just he kind of changed the game.
Very interesting. And in this production, Puppet Up, at the Montalban Theater, people can see the puppeteers.
Yeah. Yeah, we chose not to hide the puppeteers. After I'd been teaching the classes a while, you know, and Brian was like, well, should we put a puppet wall up, which is the tradition? And I said, I think it's vastly entertaining to watch the puppeteers themselves. And I'd been watching it for a long time and was not getting tired of it. So that's what we decided to do. Also, it was going to make it easier to travel the show without having to bring a puppet wall. So it created a two shows in one thing where you can be looking at the stage, watching the puppeteers, seeing how they're manipulating a puppet to make it look like it's ice skating or something. And you can also see them try not to laugh because their scene partner just started to crack them up. And then you can just avert your eyes a couple degrees up to these giant screens on either side of the stage where you see the puppets in close up, really nice close up detailed shot, beautifully lit, and in the way that you're used to seeing them on TV, kind of from like just below the chest up. So you can check in back and forth between these two realities.
We wonder how it's accomplished. Is it just like Lamb Chop, a sock on a hand? Or like when you look at Cookie Monster, like you go, there must be a couple of three people working this, but I don't know how.
Oh, well, you come to our show, you'll see how.
Yeah, exactly. And then I've been watching some classic Japanese puppetry, you know, social media. That's one of the cool things about it. And there's three or four people working these ancient dolls.
Yeah, Bukenru.
It's amazing.
It's a traditional form, and people apprentice by learning to do the feet first or something like that, and then move on to the hands after 10, 15 years. And then another 10 or 15 years, I believe, goes by, and they get to perform the head. And it's a beautiful example of the cooperative thing. We do have two people operating head-to-toe puppets in a tabletop piece that we have, where we tilt the camera down, we actually have a table, and the puppets are standing on there. So you've got somebody under the table manipulating the legs and feet, and someone else who's manipulating the head and mouth, and they've got one hand free now to have a rod for one of the arms. And they have to coordinate that to make it look like it's one sentient being moving as it intends to, or as reaction to what's going on around it. It's really fun to watch, and it's very difficult. I've tried it a little bit, you know, during rehearsals and downtimes and stuff, and my God, I would not attempt to learn how to really be a puppeteer. It's too hard.
Well, from watching these Japanese videos, Japanese puppetry, I'm seeing how just like a small tilt of the head or about can indicate joy, shame, sadness, fatigue. And I want to go back now to American puppetry and see this production and pay more attention to, like, small movements can mean big things. And as I say, you kind of have to reduce human behavior to these simple actions and convey a lot.
Absolutely, because the face of a puppet is not nearly as expressive as the face of a human. There's very few micro expressions they're capable of. So the puppeteer is really having to communicate through this sculptural piece of art and very clearly transmit to you what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they're considering, you know, just the very inner state of them. And that varies from puppet to puppet because their eyes are different styles. You know, their resting face is different. If you come and see the show next weekend, there's one puppeteer who does a piece in the show where there's a lot of stillness. And the audience just can't get enough of it because everyone's projecting. Everyone's going, I know what she's thinking. I know what she's thinking. And really, it's just a piece of fabric with two black buttons right here. But she knows how and when to do slight movements, when to look right down the barrel of the camera, when to hold, when to fold, you know. And it's really, it's very artful. So back to your Cookie Monster thing, that was two people. That would be one person doing the head and probably the left hand, and then an assistant is doing the right hand. So they have to work out if they're going to lift something, if they're going to gesture. They have to work out the timing of that so it looks like it's, you know, both hands are connected to the same brain. With Swedish Chef, who's also a live hand puppet, the way that was done is you had a puppeteer doing the head, which was Jim originally, and then Frank Oz doing the hands because Frank wanted to mess with Jim. So he would do all these crazy things, and Jim had to justify it, and I think they just loved the game of that. So that's why Swedish Chef has a little weird manic, almost like his corpus callosum was cut in his brain, and the part that, you know, is intentional is one side, and the hands have their other side doing their own life.
And I'm guessing whoever's doing the voice is the same person operating the mouth.
Absolutely. And lip sync is one of the really important skills for the puppeteers to nail and get down, because if a puppet's lips are out of sync, it creates a distance between the audience and the character. They might not even know it in the front of their brains going like, oh, the lip sync's off. They just know something's not connecting. So between eye focus directly to camera, which Jim perfected because nobody was doing it before him, and the attention to lip sync and how many openings happen with what syllables and when something closes because it's a, you know, an M or an N or a, you know, of whatever sound that's just, let's say a fricative or whatever. They have to really get that down, and it has to be second nature if they're improvising. Because if they're given a script, they can work that lip sync out at home and go, oh my God, I've got to say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Let me slow it down. If they want to say that in an improv, they better have those neural pathways very solid so that they can make that lip sync, you know, worthy of the Henson reputation. It's a lot.
It's a lot of skill and coordination. And of course, the script has to be solid. The training and the plot in the background. There has to be something there to work from. Well, I'm interested to see how it all works out with improv. But yeah. But Patrick Bristow, how has this been for you personally, developing this show?
Oh, it's been the most fun, most rewarding thing of my career. You know, would that it was a year-round job. Oh, my God. Just nothing I have done or will do approaches the in-the-moment, spontaneous joy that I get from dealing with the audiences, who often give me a hard time. They're really fun. They're sassy. And taking their suggestion, giving it off to the puppeteers, watching what they spin into a story or a slice of life or a song, I get to just join the audience then and just really enjoy it. And then when I feel like, okay, it's done, or this is a logical place to end it, I, you know, give the booth their signal and they black it out, the audience applauses, and we're off to the next piece. So, I mean, what could be a better job?
Sounds like a lot of fun.
It's criminal how fun it is. I shouldn't be getting paid for it, but do not tell our producers that.
To get paid for doing something you love.
Right?
Well done, sir.
I thank you very much. I'm sure that was my plan on some subliminal level.
Well, hopefully the next time we'll get you in studio and do a full hour of this, because there's a lot more we could talk about. But I'm glad I caught you quickly before the show goes on, talking to Patrick Bristow, who works with Brian Henson, who's Jim Henson's son, the guy who made up the Muppets. They have Puppet Up at the Ricardo Montalban Theater, puppetup.com for more information. Any closing words, Patrick?
Is the mascot at LMU still the lion?
We're still the Lions.
All right. Go Lions!